Welcome to Iteration, a podcast about programming, development, and design. My name is JP. I'm a full stack developer, and today I'm joined, as always, by John. John, how's it going?
It's going really good. I love that I tweaked the intro by a couple words and you didn't even notice. You just read it. I dropped the word weekly because you might notice that we're lately about an every other week podcast, and I apologize for that. Just JP and I have been a bit busy. But I realized last week, I was like, we're still saying weekly and we're not quite weekly. We're like every 10 days, give or take on average, I would say. So that's been tweaked. But hi, I'm John. I'm a full stack software developer based just north of LA. And today we are going to be digging into, which I love this one because it is one of my biggest pet peeves, acronyms. Acronyms in tech, acronyms in business. We're going to use it as a jumping off point for our conversation to talk through all these different acronyms, whether they're CTA, CTR, CPL, CPP. Oh, there's a huge list here. We're not just going to read off and define acronyms, though. We're going to let it kind of guide a conversation through this stuff, because otherwise it's just going to be way too crazy. But before we do that, how are your projects going, JP? How's work going? How's life lately?
Projects and work life are pretty good. I had recently joined a startup. I'm employee like number 5. Wow. We're still in stealth mode, which I keep saying. And I've been neck deep in this service as a software service as a software platform, Auth0. So it's like Auth as a service. I don't know if you've ever used it. Personally, I'm more of a gem install devise kind of person and just set it and forget it and never have to deal with Auth ever again. But boy, can I just tell you how fucking intricate authentication can be? It's ironic that it's supposed to be like a service that is supposed to make Auth really, really easy. And I get that once you use Auth0, you never really have to like worry about like all the security updates, this and that. Mm-hmm. You can offload that burden somewhere else. But I really, really feel like the first time you use it, there's that like huge learning curve that makes it like kind of hard because you're always like spending every other 5 minutes just in the docs not knowing how to do something. That being said, I feel like once you use it once and you kind of know how to use it in a project, then you start reaping the benefits. Mm-hmm. But anyways.
It's interesting because I feel like I'm seeing the Auth0 authentication flow in more projects, especially newer startups. It's interesting to see. And I looked into it a little bit and I get the pitch. Like I understand why there's some benefit there. It's almost like devise as a service, and there's a lot of benefit. It has all these social logins. There's a lot of upside to it, but it's also really fucking expensive. I was actually really surprised to see, like, per user that it's a lot more money than I would expect. And, like, there's a free project tier and some things there, but it's really interesting. I did have one specific question about Auth0 since you've been digging into it. Does it take away any of your user data, or is your user data still on your platform and it just associates it with the offsite Auth?
I don't know that I'm that deep in it that I could give you a good answer, because I could very well I could very well say something that's not true. But I believe the way that we're handling it is that the only thing that we're really storing or choosing to store is like a token. And then that token, and then we grab a user based off that token. But I don't think we actually store, for example, like
user data over there.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's a whole weird thing because like, you're using them literally as a service to house like authentication and authorization in a sense. But
yeah.
I don't know.
Does it deal with like permission level things? So this user can like can type permission level, this user can do this, or role-based security, or is it just authentication, authorization?
You know, that's a very good question. I guess that would be authorization. We do have
authorization.
We do have a concept of like different roles, but yeah. I am pretty sure that actually, wow, I couldn't tell you. Like, that very well could be part of Auth0 and how we're implementing it, but I don't know.
Nice. And you can defer to our previous episode about onboarding into a new code base to learn how to catch up into new projects and frameworks. My code life and personal life's been good lately, except somehow every year I tend to get into poison oak, and this year is not an exception. So I'm on this like anti-itch medication that makes me a bit loopy. So we'll have fun with that today. So, all right, let's get into some abbreviations. I'm ready to do this. So I'm going to kick it off by just kind of quizzing you, JP, on a couple, and then we can kind of use that as a jumping off point for conversation. Are you ready for your first question? Should we keep score here?
Sure. I love this. This is so fun. Can you imagine if, like, right, we weren't having conversations about it? That's like, this is what our podcast has become. It's just like we're listing off acronyms.
Oh, shit. No. All right. First one, API. What does it stand for and what does it do?
That would have to be for, God, this is so embarrassing. What is, like, application program interface? It has to be that.
Ding, right? Ding, ding. You got it. Yep. 1 point.
Okay. And when, what is it? See, okay. That's interesting because I feel like I use the word API for many different things now. Before, when I first got into development, API used to mean very specifically a third-party API that I interface with.
Yeah.
That was like what an API was.
Right. And like then, the Stripe API or the Twilio API. Yeah. I've noticed the same trend in my language too.
Yeah. And then nowadays, when I build like a React component or like a Vue component or like even a little like piece of functionality in a Ruby app, I'm like, oh, well, sure, what's the API for it? Is literally just like, I sometimes describe methods as like an API, mm-hmm, because that's kind of the interface in which you, I don't know, peek into a program.
For sure. I would totally agree. And I use it that way too, even though I don't think it's technically accurate, which is like, how does this framework or the code base I'm working in do this? Like, what's the convention? I almost use the word API interchangeably with convention or method or function, depending on the library that I'm using. But I think that's accurate to use in the context of React or Vue. Like, that would be React's API. No, but again, I think it's convention or functions. It wouldn't technically be the API of React. I don't know. Does React have an API? That's an interesting question. Moving on. All right, you want to give me an acronym, and we'll move to the next one.
Is the point to try to stump you? Because I just learned this one like 5 minutes ago.
Oh, shit, yeah, let's
ago.
Do it. I'm fine with it giving a wrong answer.
Okay, do you know what CRON stands for?
Oh, no, I don't. That's a great question, but it's not technically an acronym. It's an abbreviation, but I'll let you slide. So CRON, so I know it in the context of like a CRON job or a CRON scheduler that schedules nightly jobs and batches, do things like clean up, things like that. What does it stand for?
It stands for Command Run On.
Oh, shit. No, it really is an acronym. Oh, that's a good one. CRON, Command Run On. Damn, you totally spunked me.
I know. That I literally was like mind blown 5 minutes ago. I was like, oh, that stands for, I don't know why I never bothered to like look that up.
All right, so then you get a point. So now it's 2-0. So because you stumped me, it's not that I only lose a point, you get a point. So I'm 2 down now. Okay. All right, so I'm going to give you one. I'm going to give you a harder one then. TTL. Do you know what TTL means? And do you know what the concept is?
Oh man, I literally just read it, so no, I don't know it, but I know the concept is like, it's like an expiration date of sorts, right?
Or ding, ding, kind of. Like, so you don't get any points because you didn't know what it was, so that gives me a point, but it stands for time to live. So TTL stands for time to live, and it's exactly right. It's an expiration, usually in the context of a cache. So if you're caching something, and the most common place you see this is in your DNS settings. So if you're doing your domain server settings, DNS, domain name server. Hey, I should get a point for that one. So in your DNS settings, that's when you see that, which is like, how quickly should this cache bust and like reload? So 5 minutes, 2 hours, 5 hours, how stagnant should it be?
Is that specific to like DNS, or is that like also used in like cache busting general language?
No, I did some caching on a Rails project, and the gem was using that same language of TTL. Like, you set the TTL on the Rails cache to like serve up the same items for how often that cache should bust. So I think it's a general computing term. All right, you got to throw me one.
Today I learned. Okay.
See, this is fun. I like this like lightning round. This is very different.
Okay, you got to know this one. This one's a gimme. What does WebRTC stand for? Specifically the RTC.
Shit, it's not real-time chat, but it's real-time, I'm going to guess, components?
No, come on, communication.
Communication. Oh, shit, you get you another knew one. That. You're totally killing me.
You would have got that in a multiple choice. If that was like on a multiple choice type situation where you're taking a Scantron test, you would have gotten that.
Yeah, I think I would have gotten that one. Okay, but the concept is a set of browser APIs. That's how I would technically define it. A set of browser APIs that allow you to connect in real time and communicate with another browser through the web, which there's a lot involved with that, but it's most commonly implemented into like WebRTC video chat. Like right now, we're on Google Hangouts, and that is implemented via WebRTC video chat. So it stands for Web Real-Time Communications. That's a good one.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you had just kind of like mentioned like browser APIs, right? Because see, that's just how we talk about the window into something.
But I think that would be the right term. Like, when you build an iOS app, you interact with the iOS APIs available to you, right? Application program interface. Here we go. All right, let me throw you another one. Ajax. I hope I get this one.
That, well, that has to be asynchronous JavaScript. What the hell is the 8x? Asynchronous JavaScript. Oh man, I really thought I knew this one.
All right, point for me. Finally, I'm catching up. Asynchronous JavaScript and XML.
Oh, and XML,
so walk us through what that is. I know you know the concept, obviously.
Dang, I freaking knew that. And XML. Well, you use Ajax to make asynchronous like API calls when you don't want a browser reload. So the way that a front end typically interfaces with the back end is either like through server rendered code or not. I don't know. I'm probably explaining this terribly. But an Ajax call would be like an API call to your server that happens in the like asynchronously in the background, so the page is not dependent on it resolving. So
yeah.
So this like asynchronous thing can happen and get a response, and your front end can do something with that response.
Yeah, I think that's how I would define it too, which is probably not technical, but this is how people use these in practice. Like, oh, just implement an Ajax call, which would mean instead of hitting your server to handle the API call, you would just do it in your JavaScript, like over the asynchronous, which is funny that the word XML is in there because no one actually uses XML. It should be Ajax, which would be like, you know, asynchronous JavaScript and JSON.
Yeah.
Should change that X to a J because it's most commonly implemented with JSON. All right. Do you have another one to test me on?
Okay. I got a couple up my sleeve, but I'm going to give you one that I think you probably would know. And it's this FOSS, FOSS.
FOSS.
I guess it's not really that technical though. Well, kind of, but it's like in the space of,
oh man, shit. I'm going to try to cheat a bit here. Can you use it in a sentence? Is it spelling bee rules? You get to use it in a sentence?
Yeah. What's the origin?
What's the origin?
I'll give you some context. The Action Cable signaling server is FOSS.
Oh shit. I have no idea. This one flew right over my head. So you get another point. So it's 4-2. You're in the lead. You're doubled up on me. And what is this? Tell us what FOSS is.
It's free open source software.
Oh, shit. Okay, I've heard that before, but yeah, fair enough. I totally lost it.
You knew that, though. I mean, I think it's more commonly... So I've seen this both on Twitter, like OS, like open source, mm-hmm. but I also see, yep. like, FOSS, and I'm just like, that just looks weird. Like, why do you have... I don't know. Isn't open source software free, though? Like, wouldn't it not be open source if it wasn't free? It's, like, almost seems redundant.
I've seen it in context, I think it has to do with the license, whether it's like BSD or whether it's Creative Commons or what it is. And I think when it's the most open of those licenses, it's FOSS. Because like something like Red Hat is technically open source, but you can't really do anything with Red Hat code. All you can do is like improve their code base. You can't go resell Red Hat. Where Ruby on Rails, you could call it Ruby on Grails and sell it if you wanted to. So it's like genuinely free and open. But I didn't even know the acronym, so what the fuck do I know what I'm talking about? All right, I have to get one that stumps you then. Here I go. Actually, this is like an easy one, but a hard one, because I always got it wrong, so let's try it. ORM. Do you know what ORM stands for?
Relational Mapper?
I'll give it to you. It's Object Relational Mapping, and you know what the concept is.
I'll probably butcher it, but I mean, it's basically like an interface on top of, like a database layer. So like Active Record is an ORM on top of SQL, and like yep. Mongoose is an ORM on top of Mongo. So it yep. basically is, like a DSL on top of like a query language so that you can, I just used another acronym.
I know, I love it.
It's a DSL on top of like a query language to make it easier to write your queries.
Okay, so now you gave me DSL, which is domain specific language. I did know that one, even though it's sitting in front of me. And in the way that an ORM is like kind of this middle language between a simplified language and your database beneath it, like that's how the object relational mapping would interact. Just another clarification, we're not necessarily defining these in the technical terms here. This is how we hear developers use them every day and how we use these terms every day. And so ORMs are very commonly DSLs, which is domain-specific languages, which is like simplified languages, simplified kind of markup. So a lot of testing, I think the most common DSL that I use is testing languages. So it's like, you know, clicks on, goes on, and there's like a certain subset of commands you can write that's simpler. A lot of config files are written in DSL, like a Ruby on Rails, like dot files or DSL. There's a lot of different DSL. And it's interesting to me, like, I wonder where the line of DSL and language is, or if that's blurry or not. I don't know. Because like most DSL I use is technically Ruby code, but it's writing Ruby in a very specific way. But I know that Cypress, for example, a testing framework, is just JavaScript code, but it's a very specific way of writing JavaScript that's compatible with Cypress. I don't know. That's interesting.
That is interesting. And I know that like RSpec is, there's huge arguments all over the internet that date back, I don't know, probably a decade now, over like, oh, RSpec is like, the DSL is like way too, like you have to learn a whole new thing, whereas Minitest is just Ruby. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know, the line definitely is blurred there, because it's like, yeah, you're technically writing Ruby, but if you're writing your specs in RSpec, it's like, you really have to like learn a whole new thing just to like be, you know, productive.
All right, give me another one.
Okay. Oh man, I might not even know the answer to this. Do you know what IDE stands for?
Integrated Development Environment. I did know that one even before I wrote it down. And I remember because I actually had that at one point in my life written on a flashcard. I'm not fucking kidding. When I was first like learning about code and Ruby and shit, like there was so many acronyms that I couldn't keep up. And I remember at the time it feeling so important. Like, I can't write HTML and not know what it is. I can't write CSS and know what it is. And IDD was one of those words that was used in, like, some fucking treehouse course. And I wrote it on a flashcard. I remember, like, I can vividly picture, like, sitting in a Starbucks and my wife giving me flashcards for all these different software terms. Because, like, I was like, I have to learn this. I got to get it in my head. So I get a point. Thank God.
What is an IDE? And how do you use it?
Oh, shit. So off the top of my head, what is an IDE? I mean, I'll name some. So like Android Studio is an IDE, or RubyMine is an IDE, or Xcode is an IDE. All three of those are examples of IDE, Integrated Development Environment. And what it is it's a combination of like underlying tools and editor interfaces that make building software easier. That's as much as I understand it. And some of them are really cool and powerful. And it's interesting. I actually had this thought the other day that like VS Code is almost turning into an IDE because it does so fucking much for web developers. It's starting like if you just like merged Chrome and VS Code, that's it. That's a web developer's IDE. I mean, it's not quite there and you wouldn't define it as an IDE, but I don't know. Have you ever used an IDE like RubyMine or any of this stuff?
I've once upon a time, I was like trying to teach myself Java. And around that time, I was like, oh, I have to use Vim for everything. And let me tell you, there's a reason why people don't develop Java apps with Vim. And it's because like the auto completions you would get out of like a JetBrains IDE for Java is just like, it just makes you that much more efficient. I've never used like RubyMine though. I had a coworker who did once and I was just like, why do you need an IDE for Ruby? But I guess like, it's like helpful to be able to jump around easier from like, I don't know, method definitions and class definitions. I don't, it just seems kind of like a weird way to develop for me because that's not how my brain thinks.
It's not how my brain works either, but I've seen people working in RubyMine. It seems really amazing. Like it like traces back to errors and opens that section of the code for you. Like there's a lot, you can like place debuggers like visually. There's a lot of cool stuff or like look up method definitions really easily. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Cause I find myself just searching for stuff all the time. It just seems like too much to me. I like simpler tools, but I have no judgment on someone who likes an IDE. I'm just curious. I almost feel like I want to try it out, but it's expensive. I think RubyMine's like $200. I'm just like, I don't know. Adam's free.
Yeah. It's like, do I have to pay this every year? Cause you know how like along with Photoshop and all that like, stuff, you have to like pay every year. Now you can't just own
Sketch
the software
or whatever. Yeah, for sure. All right, I'm throwing you another one. Here is one that is a more generic web term, TLD.
Oh, that's top-level domain, right?
Damn it! Yes, you got it right. So what is a top-level domain?
Okay, this could be wrong, but this is what I think a top-level domain is. Okay.
All right.
So a top level domain, I believe, is basically the extension in a URL. So like a .com or like a .io, yep, or like a custom TLD would be like,
exactly right,
like .developer or whatever, or .dev. It's like the new one that came out like a year ago, and everyone's like, oh, I have to get the .dev domain. So I think that's a good definition. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm at johnjacob.dev. I'm very proud of that. It's like having an at hey email address in this moment, which is really funny. All right, who did the last one? You did it. So I need one from you. You got to give me one.
Okay. Do you know what? Okay, let me give you a gimme. What's dry?
Don't repeat yourself. Don't repeat yourself. Don't repeat yourself. Which is just a very basic soft. Is that right? That's right. That's
what you're saying,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, which is a very basic kind of software concept of don't write something over and over if you can break it out into a method and run that method in one place. So you don't want to repeat yourself among multiple places. Do you have any opinions on dry? Because I feel like some people try to make code too dry and worry too much about code count. And I think it's a good overall concept, but you can be too dogmatic about being dry. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I do. I think it's just like, it's just like one of those patterns that you're like, you learn about it, you know, when you're a noobling and you're just like, I have to use this everywhere. And then you end up creating these abstractions that are like, oh man, so hard to follow. I think my like general rule of thumb is that if I repeat something a third time, then I need to assess whether or not, and even then I might even be pushing it. Like, who knows, maybe the abstraction's not there yet. But that fourth time, then I really start to like really evaluate like, hey, maybe I shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah. What's funny, I think, is in my Ruby or backend code or JavaScript code, even, I'm more likely to repeat myself than like HTML or components. I feel like on my front end, because they so easily fall out of sync. Like if I'm going to use an avatar image, I'm going to define that in a component and never repeat myself even twice. Because then if I need to change its style, I got to go in two different places, which is kind of funny and feels a bit backwards. Okay, I'm going to give you a really hard one. You ready? PHP.
This is like a recursive thing, right? It's like PHP, gosh, what's the HP stand for? It's like, oh man, I really knew this. I know it's a recursive acronym. It's like programming, PHP programming language or something, but that's PPL. I don't know. I give up.
So there's two things here, but the number one in the original definition is personal homepage hypertext preprocessor.
Oh man, I would have
That's
never
technically
guessed
that. What it's, yeah, I knew. I knew I want to get ahead here because I gotta catch up. So now we're tied. Okay, do you have one to throw me?
Okay, let's.
And we'll just be done when you're out of them.
Okay, I'm gonna give you a really hard one, and you
okay,
might.
Well, I just gave you one that I knew you wouldn't get. So.
You might know this though because of all the JavaScript, like Wes Boss stuff you've taken.
Let's see.
Do you know what IFE stands for? IIFE. I'll give you a hint that F stands for function.
I don't know what IFE stands for. I'm ready for it. Train me, trainer.
It stands for immediately invoked function expression. So that is a function that after you define it, it immediately calls itself.
Wow. This is a concept that I don't think I'm actively even aware of. Can you explain it a bit more? Like, what's a use case for an IFE?
I'm going to butcher it. It has
All right,
to...
let's move on. All right, here's another one for you. Let's go with OOP, O-O-P.
Oh, object-oriented programming. Have to.
All right, and what's that mean conceptually?
What does that mean? That's so funny. Let's go back to all of our domain-driven design episodes. It's a concept in, it's a paradigm in programming languages where everything is defined by objects. Maybe not everything, but most things in the world of the language are defined by objects. I don't know. That's terrible definition.
Well, it's, you know, I think almost one of those things, it's easier to define it by talking about what's the opposite. So functional programming, it doesn't hold as much state and things aren't broken into objects themselves. It's more of just functions you call it, just dumb functions. They spit out data. Where an object is like, this is a cow. A cow has udders. Why did I pick cow? This is the medication, I promise. You know, a cow has udders. A cow has spots. And it's kind of defined by itself. And then you can pass data between objects. And it's, I don't know if there's any hard definition there because, you know, there's languages like JavaScript that are both functional and object-oriented. They can be. I think JavaScript is technically object-oriented, but people write it, I don't even know. Because you can have objects and functional and like everything is this, which is an object. So Do you have any thoughts there? Is it object-oriented or not? I don't think it is.
We should refer back to that episode when we had Luis on.
Oh, for real. That guy knew his JavaScript shit, man.
Yeah, it's like, it's everything. It's a you can use it in many ways, which is like the beauty of JavaScript. It's like one of those cliche, with great power comes great responsibility, yada, yada,
yeah, yada. For sure. All right, so this section is called the bullshit sales and marketing abbreviations. And I'm going to power through a couple of them here, and I'm going to give you a batch of them, JP. So this is for bonus points. So 2 points if you can answer what these three abbreviations are. So you ready?
Oh, man.
CTA,
yeah.
CTR, CPL.
Oh, okay. So CTA
is... This is all the bullshit marketing, like, on-page analytics stuff. And I've got, like, 90 of these here.
Okay, so CTA is a call to action, right? So
boom,
that would be
ding,
like...
Ding, ding, there you go.
That would be, like, the huge button that is
like,
on
sign
your
up
landing
now.
Page. Yep.
Yep.
CTR, so that I believe is click-through rate, which is
ding ding, you got it.
I don't actually know how to define that. Is that, I couldn't tell you. I could make up a definition and maybe you could tell
yeah,
me
so
how close I am.
It's depending on how many people land on your page, how many take an action on that page, so how many click through to the next page. So it's very similar to your like fall off rate, but it's most commonly used specifically on like a Google Analytics ad or an advertisement. So you have an ad displayed on page and how many people click through into that ad. But it's used interchangeably with how many people are taking an action on a page, but it's more commonly like there's impressions and then there's click-throughs for when you place online marketing. So whether it's like on Facebook or Instagram, your CTR, your click-through rate would be how many people actually like click on your shitty sunglasses to buy them.
So is it measured by people who land and then people who see it versus click? Oh, so
impressions versus clicks.
So yeah. it's like a percentage then? So you want a high percentage.
Exactly. Yep. So like a pretty average click-through rate is like less than 1%. That's like,
oh,
or
wow.
If you're thinking of like a an online ad, you're lucky if you get a 1% click-through rate for like an Instagram ad. But it depends on the ad format and depends on its context and depends on what your ad. Because if your ad is like free Mercedes-Benz and it's legit, you're going to get a high click-through rate.
Interesting. What's the last one?
CPL, which is cost per lead.
I would have never gotten that.
Yeah, and then there's CPA, which is cost per action. And there's like so many of these that all begin with a C, and they all have to do with Google Analytics, Google AdWords, marketing conversion. There's like CRO, which is conversion rate optimization. There's tons of these things. The only other two I want to call out is CPP and PPC, which is...
Oh, I know what PPC stands for.
What is it?
That's pay-per-click, right?
Boom, ding, you got another one. You just gained like 25 points ahead of me. And then CPP is cost per click. But I think the thing to like, the only thing I want to take away from here in this like whole marketing and sales lightning round is the people who use the most abbreviations that you got to get your head around is people who specialize in like analytics, conversion, marketing, conversion, more so than anyone else I've worked with, just throw you acronyms and just like, take a minute and know what those are and get your head around them because like there's so many from SEO, SEM, SMM. We're not going to make an episode of listing off abbreviations, but there's tons of these things. All right. You want to give me a couple now that we've moved out of that lightning round of bullshit marketing and sales ones?
I don't even know if I have any more for you. That might have been it, if I'm being honest.
All right. That sounds good. So let's go into some and you can open up the one in front of me. So now you can open up the notes. So now you can look. So we're out of the scoring section. And if you don't include the lightning round, JP got 8 and I got 6. And then if you include the lightning round, I mean, you just totally decimated me. So let's go through some of these business terms, because I think these are some good ones to talk through. And maybe you pick a couple off here and I'll pick a couple off here. And maybe we're not quizzing each other, but just kind of talk through these concepts. So the first two I want to talk through is KPI and OKR. So I feel like the first job I got, my boss was like, we need to talk through your KPIs and make sure you've got good OKRs in place. And I was like, what the hell is going on? So this stands for Key Performance Indicator is KPI and OKR is Objective Key Results. JP, you want to tell us what those are?
Dude, I really wish I could have a great definition of these, but I just feel like my idea of what an OKR is just so convoluted because it's just thrown around as a term for like everything, you know?
Yeah,
like,
it really
like,
is.
Like, what are your OKRs this quarter? And it's like, we use it in a sentence as like, what is your objective? And that's what it stands for, right? Like objective key result. But we oftentimes will just say like, for example, an OKR could be like, higher click-through rates, right? but it's like, is that really an OKR? Is like to get a higher click-through rate? I think it's like, that's like part of it, but I think an OKR is supposed to be like a combination of different things.
So, like, yeah, no, you're onto something. I think the biggest thing is it's supposed to be objective key result. So someone who doesn't understand your business should be able to tell you whether you succeeded or failed in that key result.
Interesting.
So click-through rate increasing could be one, but like that's shitty because it's ill-defined. Increase by what? 0.1%? What does that mean? So a good objective key result is by the end of Q1, increase click-through results by 1%. And then someone else can come in and say, is this click-through rate increased by 1%? Doesn't matter who it is. And you could say, like, it's binary, yes or no. Mm-hmm. And I've totally seen this abused where, like, oh, your OKR is to be a better coder. And it's like, what? Like, I can't give you anything. And then it's just subjective whether you pass or fail. And I'm not, like, anti-OKR, but I agree that it's thrown around too much. And there's oftentimes very unthoughtful OKRs. Like, let's say another example could be, you know, 0 500 errors thrown in production. Well, like, okay, I could just throw a rescue on the root of my production app and rescue every exception. But so you have to, like, think through what OKRs are and if it's going to be something that can be gamed or if it's actually a measure that matters. But all the investors, all the business people, all the C-level types love this fucking OKR KPI thing. It's all the same thing. It's just like, what is the shit you're trying to get done in what time period? All right, let's pick another one off here.
Okay, how about this one? It's sort of in the same vein, PRD. In the same vein of like, oh, people love this shit.
People throw it around so much, yeah. So product requirements definition or document, depending on where you are, kind of what company. But basically, oh God, this one is so big to untangle because it's can be so big and hairy and the definition can vary wildly, whether you're dealing with a client or whether you're dealing with a technical organization. I feel like this is one of those things that every organization or client's going to have their own approach on this thing and their own specific definition of what it is. Usually there's a template. And okay, let's get to what it is. It is a document that's supposed to distill the functionality of a specific feature for a product. So a product's requirement document should be like, this is the button. When you click the button, it makes a fart sound. The fart sound is 2 seconds long. The fart sound should be 1 decibel loud. And when the fart sound is done playing, it should emit a smell that is rancid. Like, that is the product definition requirement for a whoopee cushion. Like, there it is.
And how does that hit our OKRs?
Exactly. How does that map back to our OKRs? I really love a really well-written PRD, like a really well-written product requirements definition is gold if you are a software developer, but I feel like oftentimes they are not really well articulated and the scope's too big and the product's requirement definition says something like sign up more users or improve user onboarding flow. And it's like, that's not an objective product requirements definition. Do you have any thoughts here? I've been ranting too long about farts and whoopee cushions.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never like seen a really good one. I feel like I've had PMs tell me that they're like antiquated and kind of a waste of time because it takes a lot of effort to make a really good one. And so is your time better spent elsewhere? Maybe it is. Mm-hmm. So in context, I think that the PRD is usually written by like a PM, right? Who's like driving the product to say like, well,
product manager, PM. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I know. The acronyms just fly out of my mouth. I don't even realize it.
I know. It's crazy, man.
But yeah, I don't know. I'd be interested to see what a good one looks like and like in the actual context of my job and not to just like see one to see one. But I don't really have any thoughts on it. I've gotten like one PRD before at Opendoor and it was kind of it was kind of like a half-assed thing that was like kind of just slapped together. It's definitely obvious that it was like a template and you just like copied and pasted certain things here and there. And I was like, well, what was the point of this? I hope you didn't spend too much time on this because this provided very little value. But
I think,
I don't know.
Good PRDs I've seen are well scoped. So it's very focused on a specific problem set that it's trying to solve and encompasses maybe like 10 user stories at most. So it's more focused. So it defines a very specific set of functionality. So let's say you had like a basic app and there was no replies to comments. So you have something like Facebook, but there was no like nested threads. In my mind, a PRD would be the right level to define like, hey, we need replies to comments. And here's all the user stories and nuances and business incentives we're trying to drive. Here's the engagement we're trying to drive to define out how replies to comments should work at a very high level, why we're even building this thing, and what does success look like? And I think at that kind of level, it works really, really well. But if you try to have a PRD that's like, oh, photo upload, it's just like, whoa, it's just way too open-ended. So ones I've seen that are good are more that way. All right, here's one for you, JP, RFP. Do you know this one? This is really important if you're a freelancer.
Yeah, request for proposal, right?
That's right. And I remember when I was first getting into the freelance game, I had no idea what that meant. And someone's like, hey, can you send me your RFP? Oh, no, they're like, I have an RFP for you. And I was like, okay, give me the RFP. And then once I got it, I was like, okay, now I understand what it is. So request for proposal is something that businesses put out. I'll let you explain it. You knew what it is, so you have to explain it. If you define it, you have to explain it. That's the rules of the game.
It's funny. I actually know this because my very first job out of college, I was working as a graphic designer for a marketing company. And this was like the weekends that I had to like stay at work and work like 60, 70 hour weeks was because we were making RFPs. And I thought this was just like a thing that companies did. So a request for proposal is basically, it's exactly what it sounds like. You basically make a presentation. It could be in the form of like a PowerPoint, or it could just be like a really long Word doc. And it basically is, it's kind of like in many ways an essay that where the thesis is like, hey, I'm trying to convince you to hire me or to take on this thing of work, right? So I think it could be from the context of like, I want to hire you as a developer or I want you to hire me as a developer. I think it can go both ways, right?
Well, yeah, I think people use it very loosely, but in the actual definition of it, it's I am a company, let's say I'm Chick-fil-A, and I need a new Chick-fil-A app for all my online ordering. I would put out a request for proposal. I would say, hey, I'm Chick-fil-A. I want a mobile app built. And here's what I'm looking for. And then all those companies would respond to my RFP with proposals. So it's a request for proposal. But it's one of those things like pull request, which is like, who's pulling, who's pushing?
Okay.
You know, it's one of those things that gets really confusing and used interchangeably because technically I'm pushing my code to your repo, not pulling your code into mine. I don't want to go into that. But it's the same kind of thing with a request for proposal, which is I put out the request as a company and then people give me proposals. So it's like, hey, I'm Chick-fil-A, I need a new mobile app. And then, but if you're a freelancer, if you can find these aggregators of RFPs and like you have the opportunity to compete with huge firms out there. And I remember like I got to like the third round for this giant medical conglomerate. And it was, I like put in a proposal that was hundreds of thousands of dollars. And like at the end of the like due diligence, they found out that I'm just one guy with some freelancers. And they're like, nah, this is not going to happen. Like, you're not getting this business. Like, yeah, your pricing was good. And like your proposal looked good, but like, we're not giving you this business. Cause I was going up against like the Palantirs of the world, you know, these giant, you know, that type of company, or it's like big consulting, you know? All right. So this last batch of acronyms, I kind of put in the like bullshit business terms, but they're really important to know. I call them the twos. So JP, can you tell me what the twos are? B2B, D2C, and B2C.
Oh man. It's like, what?
Because they're all twos. They have two in the middle.
I know it's like direct to consumer, business to business. What was the last one?
B2C.
Is that business to consumer process of elimination?
Exactly right. So ding, ding. Can you talk us through what B2B, D2C and B2C are?
Honestly, no. Is it really just like what it sounds like? Like business to business is like, I am Amazon and I'm dealing with Facebook.
Slack is business to business. Business to business. So generally business tools or businesses selling to other business. Dunder Mifflin is a business to business company. They generally sell office paper and supplies to businesses. And then B2C, business to consumer, is like the most straightforward you could imagine, which is
like Amazon.
Amazon, but the only difference there is it's usually through a vendor. So, you know, if I'm buying, so Amazon would be more of, yeah, it's B2C for sure, business to consumer, which is like I'm buying an Anker battery through Amazon. So Anker is in a business to consumer business. But then there's this whole new class of the sexy new startup that is D2C, which is direct to consumer. So what that would be is the Casper mattresses, the Allbirds. There's nowhere to buy it but from its source. So like you can't buy that product from anywhere, or like that ramen that I was telling you about. You can only buy it from their website. So that would be direct to consumer. And this is a very sexy new space in terms of what that looks like. So, okay, I think we should call it. I have about 100 more abbreviations here, but I do want to call out, I'm going to be writing all these up into a blog post and putting that into the show notes. Cause I feel like this is the list of acronyms you need to know as a software developer. Maybe I'll even put it in just a GitHub gist so people can like submit PRs and we can add to this thing. because I feel like I Googled these acronyms with the words like software development, and they still don't come up, and I don't know what they are. So these are all the ones I've collected over my career. So I'm going to be publishing this list, and like I strongly encourage you to pull this down and peruse it for yourself. Maybe we'll do a follow-up episode with like follow-up on here. Do you have any closing thoughts on acronyms, JP?
No, other than I learned what cron jobs stand for, and also we need to maybe do an episode of like jargon, like just tech.
Ooh, just tech jargon episode. I'm into that. I like that as a follow up to this jargon episode. I am down for that. All right, so let's go into some picks. My pick is very apropos for my current situation of being covered in itchy lumps and bumps, which is Teladoc. I had never done any kind of telemedicine, even though I've technically built a telemedicine platform in my career, but I've never actually been on a telemedicine call. And last year when I got Poison Oak, I waited an hour and a half at the urgent care and it was expensive. And then I had to also go to the pharmacy 2 hours later. It was such a hassle. Had to go within their hours and drive over there. Teladoc, I literally was like, I'm itchy. I can't deal with this anymore. It was 11:30 at night. I went on the app. It was $10. With my insurance, that was like my copay. And I was actually talking to a doctor within 10 minutes of opening the app and downloading the app. And he got me a prescription. I was able to pick it up at 7 a.m. the next morning.
No
it was just
way.
Like, this is the fucking future. Like, yes, please. It was awesome. So that's my weird pick is Teladoc. If you have to like go to the urgent care for a cold or anything like that, try telemedicine. Like, give it a shot. Your insurance provider probably has it and your copay is probably like $5 or $10. It was awesome.
Interesting. We'll have to talk about that later, because I'm just curious about like the platform that you've worked on. Is it like not ready for consumption or
no? I mean,
mixing
I think
business
it is.
With personal. Or,
I mean,
okay.
No, it's fine. In the telemedicine platform I've worked on, the medical groups using it were using it for those types of things, which is like really awesome. But the difference between that one is it's a closed platform, so it's only for like in network already
Got
signed
it.
Up medical patients. It's not. Like, just open. You could be anyone in the U.S. and just go on Teladoc, even if you didn't have insurance, just pay cash. I think it's like $40 if you don't have insurance, and just go. And they're like on call, where the platform I worked on was very much like you had plastic surgery and now you need 4 follow-up calls each a week out, and we do them over we do it over video call. So it's just a different thing that I built technically than what Teladoc is. Teladoc's an online urgent care straight up. And that was pretty cool. I was like, that's 2020. That's awesome. So what do you got for us, JP?
Very cool. So I have as a pick this Ruby gem called Scenic. And what it does is it lets you... okay, so here's the problem that it's solving. If you've ever been in Rails and you have this really gnarly SQL query and you're like, shit, how do I get this into Active Record? And you're like, well, I have this SQL view, something called a SQL view, which I recently learned about. And you're like, well, how do I get this into my app? There's this gem called Scenic. And what this does is it lets you import SQL views easier. So you don't have to like do this weird thing where you're like writing raw SQL inside of like your model or whatever. At least I think so. I need to like look at this a little bit closer.
This is cool. I think we should do an episode on this. Like, this conceptually is really cool. And I bet there's other tools across other databases that do the same kind of a thing. This
yeah. How would you describe what this is now that you just popped open the README?
Yeah, I've heard this term Scenic thrown around. I've heard about the project, but I didn't really know what it was doing. But I'm just reading the README. This is my first impression. It seems like caching on steroids in a way. Like, it's a queryable cache, a queryable state of your database, like a subset of your database that's queryable. Like, you can interact with it. But I'm guessing you can't edit this data. Like, this is just to create views, like for reporting and things like that.
Right. So yeah. Like, there's a thing called like a SQL view. And I think what a SQL view is, like V-I-E-W.
I love that you're using it in practice and you don't even like know what it is fully. That's the beauty of open source, right?
It is, yeah. Well, we're using it at my current company and I was like, oh, that's cool. And I like recently realized like kind of what it's doing. And what you can do is you can create a view in SQL. So like, let's say you have a gnarly query that you don't want to translate into Active Record. You can just create like a SQL view and then you could query that directly based on the SQL view that you import into your schema.
Oh, so it's not a cache, because when you run that view, it's pulling the live data from that subset of data that you want.
Yes. So when you create like a virtual
That's
table,
the difference between a view and a cache. Okay, that's a very big difference too, because otherwise you have to keep like completely breaking and reinstituting that view. That's interesting. Thank you so much for listening. I hope this list of insane acronyms has been helpful to you. Again, I'll have it all in a blog post link in the episode show notes, and we'll see you on the next episode.
See ya. Thank you so much for listening.